The Dublin Public House is a three-part series that looks at the social importance of the pub within Dublin's changing urban environment. Funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, this series was produced by John Casey with researcher Oliver Reid. Episode 2.
They provided a place of entertainment, a place of repose, and a place for people to get drunk, or at least to have a drink or two at the end of a long journey.
That is series editor of the Making of Dublin City series and associate professor in the UCD School of Geography, Joe Brady, giving a fair and succinct summation of the pub's role in society, a place where you can leave your troubles at the door on the way in. That sense of comfort is best exemplified by the family-run pub. This episode looks at two great examples of this in the capital. John Kavanagh, aka The Gravediggers, in the unchanging environs of Glasnevin, and my local, a place that feels like another room in my house, O'Connell's on Richmond Street in Portobello.
My father worked in O'Brien's in Sussex Terrace. He had worked there for 38 years.
Proprietor and head barman, Eddie O'Byrne.
When he should have been nearly at retiring age, was his first opportunity to go into business on his own. He actually did go in with a partner. But as I say, that was the start of our history here. We're still here. The partnership is gone a long, long time ago. It is strictly family owned now. And mostly family still working in it. It has gone on to the second and third generation. Some of the grandkids are working here part-time now. Yeah. And it's just the way all pubs have always worked.
Portobello was changing markedly in the last decade. But what was it like when Eddie's family took over the pub? Valued O'Connell's patron and local history buff, Graeme Stone.
It was quite prosperous. This street was quite a busy street up until the mid-80s or beyond, really. It had a proper array of proper shops. You could do all your shopping in the street, this bit between the bridge and Kelly's Corner, everything you needed could be got here. So it was like a little village in itself. Since then, it's gone to bits because it's now just a way to somewhere else, and it's full of chippers and fast food joints. But the area was not, as it is now, gentrified and posh, expensive and desirable. In 1980 or thereabouts, it was at the very bottom of the trough. For a while before that, it had been reasonably affluent in that it was a Jewish area over the back for a while, and that sort of kept the tone of the place up. But then it was very derelict. A lot of houses were empty. A lot of houses had just old people living in, no families. So the place was very run down. Property prices were very low. There was, I think, a corpo plan to redevelop the whole area by clear felling. All you have to do is sit and wait for an area like that, and it changes. And today everyone says, oh, geez, you're very lucky to be living in Portobello. But then it was, you know, what would you think?
Really sorry that you live in Portobello.
No, in the 70s, it wasn't the sort of place people aspired to live in.
One Dublin landmark situated in an area that has remained relatively static is John Kavanagh's pub, or the Gravediggers as it's affectionately known. Kieran is the seventh generation of Kavanaghs to be found behind a bar there.
The first John Kavanagh married into the O'Neill family. The O'Neill family had this building and was here before all the houses. The houses were built in 1900, so it's pretty much, hence the cemetery beside is next door. It's pretty much countryside of Dublin. North side of Dublin was pretty much empty of houses. As I said, the square next to us was 1900 as well. Before Crossroads was a pig farm and another pig farm up the way, so it was very isolated. So the first, when they built the cemetery, which was 1832, we kind of decided, the first John Kavanagh decided to convince the family, the O'Neills, or his wife, whoever, I don't know, wasn't here, pretty much convinced them to open up a pub. And so they had a roaring business from 1833 to 1878. And then in 1878, there was a lot of pileup of coffins and hearses outside and people in here and a lot of confusion around these gates. It was after the famine, like it's been this busy, very busy cemeteries, like 1.5 million, a lot of them go back way to the start. And this end of the cemetery is the oldest part of the cemetery, it's the original main gates, the original gatehouses. So the commissioner, the head of the cemetery, decided, well, let's see, we've got to close these gates because people being late to graveside things, having the priest hang around, or vice versa, isn't so cool. So they put an end to that. It might have been also because it was expanding that way, but we kind of think it was that reason anyway. So we lost quite a lot of business. And then a guy called Joseph Kavanagh, which would have been the third Kavanagh at that stage, came back from the American Civil War. And I don't know exact dates, but he got involved in the bar business then, the pub business. And he started advertising. And we some of the old bill heads that he would hand out at the new gate. And the Newgate Cemetery, the cemetery people bought the land in front of it so nobody else could really set up anything like a business in front of it, like another pub. I'm in my late 40s now, but when I was a kid, this was Josie's. This was Kavanagh's, or Josie's. And Josie was Josephine McKenna Kavanagh, who was the fourth John's wife. John was 1911 to 1943. I was one of the Johns. And he married Josephine McKenna. In 1901 census, she was a bartender servant. And then the 1911 census, she's married with three kids to John Kavanagh. So obviously she got involved in the business. So a lot of the guys call it Josie's, also because above the door for a while it was also Joseph, and then it went to John. But then Josie ran the place because John died quite young. She ran the place, and she was wore black. She was a typical widow in an Irish pub, and she ran the place from 1911 to 1943, so through the Rising and through the Civil War, and it was pretty much a woman running the shop. So then in the 70s, my dad took over in 1973 as the sixth generation. His natural father died when my dad was young, and my dad's uncle married my grandmother to get my dad and his brother out of an orphanage out of St. Vincent's nearby. And they lived upstairs, John and his brother Fintan. And Fintan got married, it was just John upstairs. Then when he got married to my grandmother, he moved to Shandon. So nobody lived upstairs from the 1950s till 1973 when we moved in. Okay. So in 1973, my grandfather was still alive, my dad's stepfather, but we still call him granddad. He called him dad also. And that's how we got involved in the bar business, because John was a bachelor and we married into the pub. So dad took over in 73, but he was one of the first Kavanaghs to buy it. He went for sale between some of the brothers and himself, and he retired. Took redundancy from Guinness's, which he'd been working since he was a teenager, early 14 or so, and he left when he was 33, sold his house in Finglas, took a loan out and revamped the Gravediggers, as we call it, Josie's. There was quite a close connection with the cemetery and the pub, but they would have drank well into the 1980s in here, and there's some families still drink here. And every now and then we do get some of the lads, from the cemetery commission or somebody else coming in for a few drinks. There is a connection. They would knock on a wall, basically, what would happen when they were working. Right up until the early 80s as well, this happened. They would, during the workday or after the workday, or would knock on the wall with a stone or a boot or a shovel or something like that. My dad and my grandfather, or even my elder brother, remembers doing it. You'd go out the door, put the drinks to the railings.
You're looking in many cases at accidental survivals rather than deliberate survivals. Where a pub is in a family and has been in a family for a long period of time, they were much more likely to survive than a pub which was a standalone business and where you see the developer eyeing the site.
A family-owned pub can be passed down with little or no debt attached. This was something Eddie's father was keenly aware of.
My father originally, in 1970, his boss, Michael O'Brien, down in Leeson Street, had become a very, very old man, and he had decided to get rid of the pub. He couldn't manage it anymore. He put it up for sale. My father and his brother went in, tried to go into a partnership to buy it. It took a long time in those days to raise finance. By the time they had raised the finance, it was too late. He had already sold it on to his nephews. So at that time, I was working here. My father knew Jerry O'Connell for years. Like, my father was in the bar game for so long, he would have known probably every publican in this area. But while I was living here, people came in and they started going upstairs. So I kind of knew that Jerry was thinking of selling. So I mentioned it to my father, and he came up and spoke to Jerry, and Jerry did let him know that it was for sale, and they got talking, and my father could arrange the finance with a partner, and they bought it at that time.
I was surprised to hear that historically many pubs in the area adhere to a very clear order of social standing. Graham explains why.
There were a lot of other pubs in the area, many more than there are now.
Yeah.
And they all had their position sort of socially. Or the Portobello in the old days was the posh Protestant pub, and it had been for years, really. It was always Protestant. It was always sort of in a different category, really. It was
It was a more posh pub.
Yeah. When it was owned by
Searson's,
the people who had the pub down in Bagot Street as well. But again, it was a family long of an Anglo sort of family, and the pub was like that. it had a skirmish in 1916 where the barman tied up the owner and firing on the Brits across the canal, escaped through the cellars, leaving the owner tied up. But the joke of it was that the owner was very much a Brit. You know, the next one down.
Banbricks.
Used to be Banbricks, now the Bernard Shaw. During the 20th century, got lower and lower and lower in its socio-economic profile until by the time the Banbrick family sold it, it was the place, when you were barred from everywhere else, was the only place you could get a drink. The lower deck across the road was very much more Indian territory sort of pub, had vague IRA overtones and was messy and dangerous and whatever. It's much cleaner these days. There were three or four pubs in Charlemont Street giving opposition to, so the people who lived in the flats could easily have crossed the road, and there was quite a selection that they could have gone to. They still came here because all the pubs on the other side of the road were a bit rough and ready.
Social standing was clearly defined inside the walls of the Dublin pub for many years, with women not allowed to be equal participants in the pub experience. This is despite the fact that historically women had owned and run pubs in the capital, with the Gravediggers and O'Connells both falling into that category.
Pubs were always gendered spaces. They were male spaces. So the coming into a pub of women was always controlled. You had snugs in some of the older pubs, so the snug had the advantage that it was in the pub but not of the pub, and it was expected that women would take themselves to the snug if they wanted to have a drink. A woman needed really to be accompanied by a man to be secure in a pub. A woman on her own would certainly attract attention and would attract unfavourable comment. And that continues really right through. It's only again as Irish society changes, as it changes in the 60s into the 70s, that the idea of a woman going to a pub on her own, seen as a reasonable one, and I was going to say accept it. It's hard for the older clientele to accept this. And then you would sometimes find that as a halfway house, that pubs would be creating bars and lounges. And the idea was that it would be acceptable for a woman to be found in a lounge, but for a woman to go into a bar was really seen as going too far. And that persists all the way through the 70s.
As Joe points out, the idea that the pub was no place for a woman became a hot political debate in the 1940s.
You find TDs expressing their concern about the fact that women are to be found more often in pubs. And so you get Patrick Cogan, TD, concerned that women are allowed to drink alcohol at the same age as men, and reckoning that women should be older before they should be allowed to drink. And when it got into the Shannon, you find Senator Goulding, for example, hearing stories that women were to be found drinking in bars in the county borough. I mean, apparently this was a new idea to him. Or you get Senator Martin O'Dwyer wondering if they might be banned from drinking in pubs entirely. He recognised that might be an infringement on their rights, but he felt that no decent woman would object.
Women didn't have their own money. So they didn't have the spending power, so they had to be very, very careful with what they spent. But it's only when women start getting jobs and things that everything opened up. Like, it opened up that they'd work in bars, it opened up that they'd go into bars, everything like that happened. But it just happened because they became more financially independent. In those days, the only time you see a woman behind a counter in a bar in Dublin would probably have been because she was the owner. People would nearly be in shock to see a woman behind a counter.
There are pubs in the 1970s in Dublin who will not serve pints to women in the bar. You know, and this is regarded as, you know, the final step, the holding back of the barbarians, because once they're allowed to drink pints in the bar, well, then there's no end. Civilization as we know has ended.
When the smoking ban was introduced in March 2004, it had a big impact on the feel and atmosphere of pubs.
I didn't like it at the time when it started, because it did actually impact a lot on the business. People have got used to it now. For everyone's sake, it has to be a good idea. I remember years ago, even though this is a small pub, when smoking was permitted, you would be fairly lucky to see the far end of the pub through the smoke. It was actually that bad. When the front door would open, if you're on the patch, you'd see a plume of smoke coming out. You'd think the place was on fire.
We actually did really well from the smoking ban because a lot of people stopped coming here. It was very, very smoky, hence the colour of the walls and the ceiling. You know, that doesn't happen overnight, and that's not a computer program from a paint company. That's nicotine.
But if you look around the city at any of the regeneration areas, it tends to be very different kinds of facilities that are put into those project areas, because and planners will be quite open about this. They want to attract a different social class into the city, so they want to get a better mix. But that can often be divisive if it's not managed properly.
That was Niamh Moore-Cherry, Associate Professor of Urban Governance and Development in the UCD School of Geography, making a valid point. And while the locale of the Gravediggers is unsuitable for redevelopment, in the Dublin 8 area, redevelopment and gentrification are happening at a rate of knots. Record high house prices and rent have given the area a sheen of exclusivity that wasn't there until relatively recently. This is reflected in a clientele that now frequents O'Connell's, whose pool of customers Eddie once would have known by name.
And the first 25 years of our history here, 90%
back further, we don't know that.
Yeah. No, but guessing, but for our time, it was definitely local. It was local trade. You'd know a stranger if they came in.
The Corpo redeveloped the back in the middle of the 60s, and there were hundreds of people living on the flats. They all adopted the pub. It was a bit like a club for a long time, in that you knew almost everybody, and if you'd come in, there'd be only maybe one or two people you wouldn't know personally, and you knew about their families and their history and their sick grandmother and their newborn babies and all that sort of stuff. It was going on because it was very much community centre.
Would you find any when people were coming in, you wouldn't even have to order?
You know immediately when you see someone. But in those days too, like, a lot of our trade would have been from the people who lived in Tom Kelly Road, which is now demolished. And the reason they would probably have been our most loyal customers was because they were living in corporation accommodation, which was reasonable rent. So they were the type of people who had spending money, and they spent their money in pubs.
What were drinking habits like back in those days?
Originally, we had people 7 days a week. And if they had decent jobs, a lot of them in construction where they were earning good money, they might be in twice a day. They might come in before they'd have their tea, and they'd come back for the last hour of night. And they were good spenders.
There used to be people of my age who would be retired and who would always drunk here, and in their retirement would come in here at 11 o'clock
It'd
in
be
the morning.
The daytime would be their
and
their
have
time.
A few pints. Yeah. They'd stay here from 11 till maybe 3. That'd be their day in the pub. They wouldn't come at night at all, really.
No, no, no.
And there were enough of them to keep the pub in business, that they'd be the day customers.
Then unfortunately they died.
Yeah, but they weren't. There was no replacement.
People's habits have changed. Yeah. People's drinking habits have changed.
Otherwise, you expect natural replacement. People just get older and they would become... But it didn't happen like that. When they died, nobody came to the pub at 10:30 or 11 in the morning ever again. And so...
Yeah, well, what we would have been talking about years ago, like older people, their life was the pub. They didn't go to Lanzarote for holidays or anything like that. But now they are gone. They're gone away and they have spread their wings, more or less.
Yeah.
So they're doing different things. And like, fair play to them. It probably is a better life for them.
Given its proximity to Glasdevin Graveyard and stories of ghosts on the property, the Gravediggers has now become a destination spot for fans of the paranormal. Is there any substance to this? Because of
mine. Well, the old one is, it's full of spirits, but that goes back to the fact that we sell whiskies and stuff like that. But, there has been occasions. My dad had a lot of time for anybody who was doing something, who's doing a project or a paper or a hobby or anything like that. So he involved a few mediums and a few ghost hunter people, and he brought them in after hours. And, you know, he had some interesting situations that popped up. There's a couple of people, I can't remember the name, they had a really good time here, got a lot of contacts and a lot of stuff like that. I wasn't present. There's been a few things over the years. My sister claims to have had some kind of apparition thing in her when she was younger, going through her room. There's been my uncle here one time, there was rattling the keys, dog going a bit crazy. We also used to have Alsatian dogs here, as guard dogs, and dog got scared, he got scared, left the building. Other people left the pub, said there was a guy down at the back still drinking. It was the 70s, you know, they might have had a good few drinks themselves. I don't know, I personally haven't seen anything, The only thing I can say is you do feel a certain history and I guess family pride and stuff when you do stand behind the counter or when you walk through the pub. There is that kind of, it's not eerie, but there is, especially night time or early in the morning when there's nobody here, you can see that it's been a lot of stuff has gone over here in the past, you know. So I guess there's lots of energy, if you want to say that. And you know, we've had people coming in trying to do seances because they decided the cemetery, and I've told them not to do it because it's bad luck and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, it's, why not?
The Gravedigger seems to have a clear aversion to technology. I wondered, was this purely a selling point or something that was important to maintain the atmosphere of the place?
I think it dates back when my dad took over in the early 70s. We lived up upstairs, number two wasn't built, so it was a very noisy place to have four kids and then eventually six kids. So we stopped all kind of music and singing and anything like that. It was just about playing Game of Rings if you want. But there was dominoes back then, maybe a bit of cards and just conversation. And like when we built next door in 1980, they decided the same policy was going to be. And the policy was there was a lounge, so it was carpeted. No kids allowed, no crisps allowed. There was no music, there was no singing. It was just go for a quiet drink, I guess. And it was in different kind of sections. And then in the 1990s, when the football kicked off and Sky and everybody got into pubs, we didn't. And the lounge kind of changed a lot because of that, because the younger crowd would say, hey, we'll meet up with the Gravediggers and head off and watch a match or something. So it kind of, that side of the business changed a lot. Whilst this became kind of known for where you went for a quiet drink, you know, people had tried to have sessions and the Luke Kelly story and all that kind of thing after his funeral, and people trying to, like, sing and stuff. It just doesn't happen. You know, that's what we do. It's become known for that now, so if we change that, it would be really bad for our business.
Everybody was all over at the 45-metre line, and the referee finally does blow the whistle. It's all over, and Dublin are again the champions. Jim Gavin, you wouldn't think he had won a match. He said beforehand, it's just another game. But look what it means to the fans.
If the Gravediggers is your regular haunt, you'll have noticed a strong GAA connection, with hundreds of fans taking their pints out onto the green for post-match celebrations and commiserations on final day.
In the early 80s, a lot of the guys who playing for Dublin, for example, were from Nafina. And Nafina is very close and very much associated with the pub. So we got a lot of clients from them. And then it's become this tradition now that it's on the street. And, you know, it's a destination. I think with the people moving to the outside of the city centre, like Dublin people being transplanted to Meath or to whatever over the years, so because of housing crisis, a lot of lads will drive in with their kids who are wearing Meath jerseys and they're wearing Dublin jerseys, and they drive back home, so not having a pint. If they are, they're having one before the game, but they're not drink driving, they're going to their club, which is great, you know, that's what you want to see. So there's a little bit of change in that, but then you get the guys in whatever age group who will meet up here, or else guys with their sons who've grown up from having crisps and lemonade and having pints with their dad now.
When asked about the more annoying aspects of running a bar, Eddie gave a refreshingly honest and relatable answer.
Christmas jumpers I hate. Christmas jumpers I hate. And it's not because it's Christmas or anything like that. It's just that over the years we have had incidents where when you get a gang of 40 or 50 people into a small pub like this to take over the pub, they're obnoxious. They're rude to everyone else. They try to steal stuff. They're going to stay for one drink. If they can't finish it, they'll throw it on the floor. So they're not worth having. So, you know, like if I met them at the door, I'd send them on their way. I wouldn't allow it because they upset. What are our 364 days of the year customers? Why should you allow it, you know, for a half an hour?
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, like I hate it. I hate it. You know, I don't hate them. I just hate the ones that behave obnoxious.
I've got a Christmas jumper too, but I don't wear it in here.
Good idea.
One question we posed to everyone in this series was whether those behind the bar had a duty of care towards regular heavy drinkers.
No, yeah, not the fact that they're drinking that much. Yeah. But you would feel a duty of care. Like, you're never going to let them come to any harm. Like, we have some people like that. And the majority of people that drink that way, they drink that way because they're lonely. They've nowhere else to be. They feel comfortable sitting here, and people will know them as they come in. They might chat to 10 people in the daytime. If they sat at home, they'd talk to no one. Even though they might drink all day, the majority of them don't drink to real extremes. They pace themselves. They have to because it's a financial thing. Of course, you wouldn't like to see anyone doing themselves harm, but
you know. To that, there's some things Eddie can't say here, but for modesty's sake, I think. I don't know whether you've noticed here, but anyone who has had too much to drink will never get served here. They get rejected politely, but rejected nonetheless. If they're obviously gone too far and they really shouldn't be having another drink, one way or another, they will not get another drink. Now, generally it's dealt with very politely rather than making a scene, but that's the sort of duty of care that pubs have too. In the more personal a pub is, the more able that is to happen. In an impersonal pub where the barman doesn't know you and you don't know the barman, you can probably get completely lacquered and fall down on the floor and you'd still get another drink.
In the course of putting this episode together, I was surprised to learn just how central the pub was to some people's lives in Dublin, an older generation of people. I was heartened to hear Eddie's description of them getting out of the pub and boarding planes to Lanzarote, seeing what else the world had to offer.
The pub has changed. The pub is not just a place now where you go to have a drink. The pub is now a place where you go to eat food. You may be part and parcel of the entertainment there. People's drinking habits have changed. The drink driving legislation has had a profound effect on what people do of an evening. So you find that pubs are now competing with a whole range of different entertainment facilities, and they're not necessarily that distinctive.